The following is a production of Omnis.tv.
Tonight's show, we have special guest Jeff Sack talking NBA playoffs. Also tonight, boxing news, this weekend at the box office, Major League Baseball recap, and much, much more, only here on Unsigned, happening now. Hey everybody, my name is Ryan and welcome to Unsigned. It is Tuesday night. It is 9 o'clock. A lot of things we want to cover this evening. Like I said at the top of the show, NBA playoffs, boxing, Major League Baseball, movies, music, lots of things we always cover here on Unsigned. And a very, very special guest, Jeff Sack, the Sack Man, is on with us tonight. Jeff, how are you doing today?
I'm doing fine, Ryan. How about yourself?
I'm doing well. Jeff, again, thanks for doing the show. Really appreciate it. And we'll just jump right into it, if that's okay with you. We're looking at NBA action, a game in progress right now, in a series that's been pretty interesting. The Chicago Bulls hosting the Atlanta Hawks tonight in Game 5. Now, down in Atlanta this past weekend, Derrick Rose put on a great performance, 44 points, career off playoff high, 16 of 27 shooting, 7 assists. But in Game 4, the Hawks come back and tie that series up 2-2. Behind, you know, Josh Smith and the young fella, Jeff Teague, filling in for Kurt Heinrich. What are your thoughts of the Hawks making a series of it?
I'll tell you something, Ryan. I am very, very impressed with Jeff Teague. This is a young man that really did not get a lot of playing time in the last couple of years. He had a celebrated game last year in his rookie season when he subbed for Mike Bibby. But other than that, really did not have a lot of claim to fame. And has really stepped in and done quite an admirable job in place of Kurt Heinrich, who, of course, got hurt just before this series started. And he's kept Atlanta in this series basically almost single-handedly through a lot of the games. Of course, Josh Smith had the huge performance in Game 4, as you just alluded to. And Joe Johnson, of course, is the heart and soul of the team. And Al Horford, of course, had a big game as well. And Jamal Crawford, former Sixth Man of the Year, a very, very dangerous player, has given Chicago a lot more than they expected from and a lot more than most NBA observers expected from Atlanta in this series. So they've done quite an admirable job so far. Of course, Derrick Rose, the MVP of the year, and deservedly so, and he's shown that throughout this series. And Tom Thibodeau is the NBA Coach of the Year and has done a nice job getting his club to where they're at right now, especially considering they were basically a dysfunctional team last year under Vinny Del Negro. Boozer has had his problems with injuries, having turf toe through this series. Luol Deng is basically their right-hand man to Derrick Rose and has done, again, a great, great job in this series. I expected Chicago to win this series very, very easily. My original prediction was 5 games, so I've been very, very shocked with the way Atlanta's done, but it's been a great series and it's been great basketball to watch. Absolutely.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Josh Smith and Joe Johnson combined for 47 points, 17 rebounds, and 13 assists in that Game 4. Now, you know, Carlos Boozer has been nicked up, as everyone knows. Even still, I mean, I think that, you know, Joakim Noah, who I love, I think he's really a great presence underneath the basket for Chicago. And the fact that they got out-rebounded and really handled in Game 4 came as a shock to me. And I alluded to this on the show last week that the big men of Chicago must outplay the big men of Atlanta, and right now it's a draw, and Luol Deng has really been inconsistent. I expect Chicago to win this series. Do you think moving forward, who do you think is going to be pivotal for Chicago moving forward if they're going to make it to the finals?
Well, I had said in my pre-series predictions that I thought the critical matchup in this series was Noah versus Al Horford. I am not as big of a fan of Noah as you are, and a lot of people are. I think the guy is a lot like Anderson Varejao from the Cleveland Cavaliers, instant energy and very, very enthusiastic, but he's not a very skilled player. And it kind of reminds me of that old college friend you've got who never kind of grew up. too much into the partying, too much into being the, you know, the kind of the fool of the bunch. He's, again, very, very focused and very, very energetic on the court, but certainly not a center that would have been able to play back in an earlier era when we had players like Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and Robert Parrish and, of course, Russell and Chamberlain. Horford, to me, is more of a prototypical center and one of the better young players in the NBA today. Certainly not among the class of a Dwight Howard by any stretch of the imagination, but in today's NBA, where there really are not a lot of quality big men, I've always been a big fan of Al Horford. So, I predicted that was going to be the key matchup so far or before this series started, and so far it's proven to be a good bellwether for this series. And that's basically, I agree with you, Noah. Boozer and Deng are going to have to pick it up no matter who they go up against. Chalmers and Bibby have not done a fantastic job for Miami, but Derrick Rose can't win them all by himself. He's going to need some help from his teammates in order for them to be able to get Miami or Boston if they do somehow come back from their 3-1 deficit.
Gotcha. I completely understand. I completely agree with you as well. And a guy that I really like off the Chicago bench that hasn't seen a lot of time but played really well during the regular season was Taj Gibson when Boozer was hurt, when Joakim Noah was hurt. I'm surprised with Boozer being nicked up that Thibodeau hasn't gone with him a little bit more during certain stretches. Does that surprise you at all?
I'm, again, a big fan of Taj Gibson as well, and I thought that was a very, very big move for them to pick him up. I guess it was last year. He's done a superb job off the bench, I agree. Again, I think they're just trying to get Boozer more into the flow of the offense, and they're basically trying to work him in slowly, especially against a team that they thought they weren't going to have a lot of problems with, so that they can get him ready by the time they get to the Eastern Conference Finals or the NBA Finals if they make it that far.
Gotcha. So, Hawks, well, I would give you a quick score update, and I'll ask for your prediction, Jeff. Right now, Chicago's jumped out to an early 40-31 lead. It's about 5 minutes to go currently in that game in the first half. You think Chicago will sew this up later this week when they go down to Atlanta if they win the night?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. Absolutely. I expected this series to be over long before it's going to be over, and I think they had their problems, but I think they're finally starting to realize them. As you just mentioned, it's now 40-33, and they seem to have this game well in hand, and I expect them to be able to get by the Hawks and match up against either Miami or Boston, whoever makes it to the Eastern Conference Finals out of that series.
Completely agree with you, Jeff. Again, this is Unsigned. My name is Ryan. We have special guest Jeff Sack with us here this evening. Jeff, we'll continue on going just the Eastern Conference. You have the Miami Heat, much talked about Miami Heat, and the Boston Celtics now with that 3-1 lead, as you mentioned earlier in the series. It's really been fun to watch a star-studded matchup that the NBA has got to love. You have LeBron, Dwayne Wade, Chris Bosh against the big three, Ray Allen, Paul Pierce, Kevin Garnett, really a classic matchup. Unfortunately, Boston came up short last night. Their injury list is as long as their bench at this point. Do you think they can go to Miami tomorrow night and force a game six?
I had predicted Boston was going to win this series in seven games. After last night, I am revising that prediction. Unfortunately, being a Boston fan and growing up and being raised in Boston before I moved to Cleveland many, many years ago and covered the Cavaliers for 11 years, I grew up rooting for the Boston Celtics. In fact, my first 13 years on this planet, they won 11 championships. So I grew up during the Russell, Jones, and Havlicek era, the golden age of the NBA, as I call it. And I really thought that it was going to take a full year for the Miami Heat to be able to gel together, bringing in as many players from as many organizations as they were doing. I did not expect them to be able to get by the Boston Celtics. I thought their experience would carry them through this series and take them all the way to the NBA Finals. Last night was a coming-of-age moment for LeBron James. This is a young man who I used to be an extremely huge proponent of, maybe one of his biggest fans in the media. I covered him from the time he joined the Cleveland Cavaliers. In fact, the first time I interviewed him was before the McDonald's All-American game when he was still a senior in high school, and was very, very impressed with the way the young man conducted himself and the way he handled himself through his first 4 years of his career that I covered in Cleveland, and really expected him to be back with the Cavaliers last summer. Of course, he disappointed all of Cleveland and shocked most of the fans of the NBA when he decided to take his services to South Beach, in his own words. And because of that, I lost a lot of respect for the guy, because he had always proclaimed to be a leader and the heart and soul of the Cleveland Cavaliers. And here it was, a chance for this guy to do like Kevin Durant did and stick with his team and show the faithful from Cleveland that their support was warranted. And he took off and went and basically did the same thing he did when he went to high school 8 years ago, and that was this time follow Dwayne Wade to Miami rather than follow Louis Blatt Jr. to St. Vincent, St. Mary. And instead of being a leader, in my mind, he became a sheep. But last night, the guy's athletic ability and the guy's stones came through big time. He had an incredible game, both defensively and offensively. Basically muscled the Miami Heat into the overtime period. And then he and D-Wade won that game in the extra period. And Boston right now is on the ropes with their backs against the wall, down 3-1, and they have to win outright in order for them to advance. And I don't see that happening, unfortunately.
Yeah, I have to agree with you. I think Boston with their leadership of Paul Pierce and the way that late regulation ended with them, the isolation play with Paul Pierce was very shocking. Garnett was as good as he was in game three. As good as Garnett was in game three, he was just as bad for game four. And I mentioned on the show last week that he really needed to be the Kevin Garnett of old consistently, and I don't know if he's able to do that and put up 20 and 10 every night. He shot 1-for-10 from the field there in game four. But the effort of Rajon Rondo, really the only guy on that team that really has a lot of years of basketball left in him, and his performance playing with one hand was absolutely amazing, I thought.
I would put Rajon up there right now with Kevin McHale in 1987 when he played with a fractured foot against the Los Angeles Lakers as the Celtics lost the NBA Finals. I would put him up there right now with John Havlicek back when I was a little boy who dislocated his shoulder and ended up playing as the Celtics won the championship in 1974. Larry Bird broke his orb bone during a game against the Indiana Pacers. Willis Reed, of course, many, many years before you were born, when I was a little boy, played with a broken leg in the 1972 Finals. Rajon Rondo, to me, is that type of athlete and that type of competitor, that he's willing to sacrifice his body for the good of his team. And you don't see that too often anymore in professional sports. And as much respect as I've got for Rajon Rondo before this incident happened, it has been increased tenfold by the way he's conducted himself, not only Sunday when he came back into the game, but yesterday as well, when you could see that arm was basically hanging limp by his side for most of the game, but the guy still put up double figures and was able to dish off 5 assists. So you can't ask for anything more out of him. Again, LeBron and D-Wade are just doing an absolutely masterful, masterful job. And Chris Bosh had a nice game last night, really the first time in this series that he really showed up, and that was all they needed. As Boston really took abysmal, abysmal shot selection in the fourth quarter and in the overtime period, and their turnovers were just absolutely incredible as well. So between those two factors, Boston basically shot themselves in the foot. It was a game they should have won. It was a game they needed to win, especially on their own home court. And now they head back to Miami tomorrow down 3-1, and basically it's win or go home.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Now, switching gears a little bit on you in this series, the Rondo incident with the elbow, probably one of the most grotesque scenes you ever see of a guy's elbow being dislocated, for him to go back, reset the elbow in the locker room and come back out and play, and then, you know, put in 38 minutes last night. Now, you mentioned, you know, LeBron James as far as how he handled himself early in his career. Did you catch any of the post game when Dwayne Wade at the end of game three was asked if that was a dirty play with Rondo, and then LeBron James muttered the words, "Oh, that's retarded," under his breath? Did you catch that at all?
Yes, I did. Yes, I did. And these two have been sticking up for each other all year, Ryan, so you had to expect something like that to happen. You know, when LeBron earlier in the season, actually during training camp, had started talking about whether the backlash against him was a racial incident or not, Dwayne Wade stuck up for him, even though Wade had to have known that it was no way, shape, or form racially motivated. And when the two of them did not finish well in the MVP voting, Wade again stuck his nose into it. So I was not at all surprised to see LeBron sticking up for his teammate. That's his boy. That's his boy. That's the reason why he went to Miami to begin with.
Yeah, it's interesting how these guys are very apologetic and everything is, oh, well, we're sorry, we didn't know it was going to offend anyone. You know, and it's just kind of interesting, you know, the elitist entitlement that these guys have developed. And I can only imagine how bad it'll get if they win a title. And speaking of a title, do you think if, you know, if it comes down to Chicago and Miami, do you think Chicago has enough firepower to beat Miami in a best of seven?
No. Pure and simple, I don't, unfortunately. And again, it comes down to just a lack of athleticism on that team. They just don't have it. Again, you know, I love Derrick Rose. I love Luol Deng. I love Carlos Boozer. Deng and Rose are definitely athletes. Boozer is right now certainly not as flexible as he normally is. Noah, to me, again, is not really an athlete per se. He's more of like an automaton, a machine, and I just don't see that they've got the flexibility and the athleticism to be able to go up against Miami in a seven-game series, and they certainly don't have the experience.
Yep, I'll give you that. As much as it pains me to say, and I said last week on the show, I think that the Heat have finally kind of found their niche and really been the most consistent in the playoffs outside of the Dallas Mavericks. And I guess it remains to be seen. I think it'll be a good series, and I think if Chicago can find a way to play enough defense, and I just don't know the workload. Being in Cleveland, we saw the workload that was placed on LeBron in the playoffs when it came down to it, and I just don't know if Derrick Rose, as great as he is, can put up a workload like that and be the best player on the floor for four games.
Not at this point of his career. I think a year or two down the road he will be able to, but I don't think at this point of his career.
Gotcha. Well, Jeff, again, that's a wrap on the Eastern Conference. Again, if you're just joining us, my name is Ryan. This is Unsigned. We have special guest Jeff Sack on the show. We're covering the NBA playoffs, and we're moving to the Western Conference right now in a series that I love and I know that you love as well, and that is the Memphis Grizzlies, the number 8 seed against the Oklahoma City Thunder. And what was a classic Western Conference shootout last night in a triple overtime game. This has really been one of the best series to watch. Two young and up-and-coming teams with a boatload of talent on both sides. Again, Memphis comes up with the short end of the stick last night at the mailbox, the AKA FedEx Forum in Memphis. Jeff, how do you see this series playing out heading back to Oklahoma City this week?
You know, Ryan, last night I wrote, if you perchance are not watching the second round matchup between the Oklahoma City Thunder and the Memphis Grizzlies, you're truly doing yourself a major disservice. And that's, I can't think of a more apt way to describe this series. It may be, when all is said and done, the best playoff series that we see this postseason. Two scrappy, two young, energetic teams filled with young athletes. And just going at it tooth and nail against each other. Some great, great players on both teams. Two of the finest young point guards coming up in the NBA today. Russell Westbrook, to me, is probably one of the most underrated point guards in the NBA. Probably a lot of that has to do with the fact that he plays in Oklahoma City, and they don't get a lot of media coverage in that particular market. And Mike Conley, as I mentioned to you earlier today, a guy who I've been a fan of since he played for Ohio State. And when he came out that year in the draft, I expected him to do better than Greg Oden has done in his NBA career. And as we discussed earlier today, of course, that's really not fair for Oden because he has been injured as long as he's been in the NBA. But Mike Conley's done a great job and really stepped it up during this series. Zach Randolph, what can you say about this guy? This was a guy who really was a pariah for most of his years in the NBA before he joined Memphis last year. Had a terrible, terrible, terrible reputation when he was playing for the Portland Trail Blazers, and then a very, very bad reputation for fading away down the stretch of games for the New York Knicks. And, of course, he was traded a couple of years ago and then signed as a free agent with Memphis last year when they also tried to sign Allen Iverson as well. Of course, they crashed and burned with the Iverson signing, but they found themselves a leader and a star in Zach Randolph as he made his first All-Star team last year and has literally carried this team just about as far as they've come so far during this playoff run, beating the number one seed, the highly favored but elderly and ran out of gas in the first round, San Antonio Spurs, and are giving the Oklahoma City Thunder so far everything they possibly can take. And last night was just an amazing, amazing game with each team making a myriad of runs and then the other opponent catching up with them. And until it got down to the nitty-gritty, and they got into the fourth period and the first and second overtimes, and then Memphis just basically ran out of gas in that third overtime. Again, two teams that I'm just absolutely enthralled with and I think are both going to be major, major forces in the next few years in the association. You got Kevin Durant, you got Russell Westbrook, you got Serge Ibaka, and you got James Harden as your nucleus right now with OKC, and Kendrick Perkins, once he starts to get acclimated to that system, I think is going to be a huge, huge asset for them and give them the presence in the middle that they need. Whereas the Memphis Grizzlies, of course, have Randolph, as I just mentioned, O.J. Mayo, Mike Conley, one of the toughest young centers, a far tougher creature than his brother is, Marc Gasol, playing in center for the Grizzlies, and this guy just brings it every night he goes out there. And again, you know, hit the 20-20 club the other night as he hit 21 points, and I think he had 21 rebounds as well, which is one of the most exclusive fraternities in the association. It's even tougher to get a 20-20 night, Ryan, in the NBA than it is to acquire a triple-double. That's how rare a feat it is. But they've already had two of those in this series, one from Gasol, as I just mentioned, and one from Zach Randolph in the game before. And I'll tell you, you can't say enough good things about that team. And they're playing without one of their better players in Rudy Gay. So when he comes back next year, Katie barred the door for that team because they're going to be a team to contend with for the next few years for sure.
Oh, I completely agree. I like both of these teams a lot. The upside is amazing, you know, when you look at both clubs. One thing I wanted to bring up, Kevin Durant last night, obviously, you know, in the third overtime, he really, you know, kind of put the game away. He was 9 for 20 from the field, scored 35 points, had four steals. You know, but he got to, you know, the charity stripe last night. He had 18 shots, made 16 of them. There was a stretch there in the game where he went about 9 minutes, really didn't have an impact there for the first, second overtime, and kind of the end of the fourth quarter. Well, Russell Westbrook, who I love, I think he's a really strong, solid point guard. Sometimes, and I've kind of criticized him on the show here a little bit, as far as his, not necessarily the volume of shots, but his shot selection, which gives him the volume. He took 33 shots last night. What do you think about the criticism he's received as far as his shot decision-making?
I think it's valid. I think it's valid. But the guy is more of a hybrid than he is a prototypical one. He's not like a Rondo. He's not like a Chris Paul or a Deron Williams that thinks pass first and shoot second. He's more in the mold of a Derrick Rose, who could play a one or a two. And that's basically the way I see Westbrook, and that's why he puts up as many shots as he does. But he knows when to get the ball into Durant's hands, as he's proven over the last couple of seasons. As this is a team that's really rebuilt in a hurry. In fact, both of these teams really rebuilt in a hurry. Let's look at the way that the Memphis Grizzlies were falling apart in 2008 when the Lakers went to their first NBA Finals after they had traded Paul Gasol to the Lakers, and the way Chris Quinn, who I criticized extremely back in 2008, has rebuilt this team. He literally is built them from the ground up, and right now he's got a young team that I just said, as I just said a couple of minutes ago, is a force to be reckoned with in the next few years of the NBA. So you're gonna have flies in the Vaseline, as it were, and you're gonna have little slip ups every once in a while, and you're gonna have, sure, when you're dealing with young players, you're gonna have players that maybe get a little too enthusiastic or maybe go outside their comfort zone or their given role a little bit, and I think that happens with Westbrook. But I think when all is said and done, he gets Durant the ball at the right time, you know, during the right part of the game, and that's the most critical thing for a point guard in the NBA.
Yeah, and we talked earlier today on the phone that that move that Durant had, the between the legs, behind the back, pull up 24-footer, you know, to close out the third overtime, was something that I think there's probably only about three or four guys in the league that would even attempt and even try to make it, you know, and it was just really something to see for him to, you know, at the end of that third overtime where he was like, you know what, enough's enough, let's close the door, and he definitely did. Now, you know, game four is epic.
My brother.
Oh, yeah, no doubt. As epic as game four was, the emotional highs and lows of that game, the benefit for Oklahoma City after a game like that is going back to Oklahoma City to play at the Thunderdome at home. Does Memphis, are they at an emotional disadvantage, you think, going, you know, have now hit the road after such a high and low game at home and now having to go and face that very energetic crowd in Oklahoma City?
You know what? I think they're too inexperienced to really know that they don't have a chance. So I think that kind of overrides any of the defeat that they got last night. The most positive aspect, if you're rooting for Oklahoma City, would be the fact that Oklahoma City got their home field advantage or home court advantage back again last night with that game, because they had lost it in game one. They're playing with house money right now. They're very, very loosey-goosey. They're basically like Boston was last year when they got into the finals. Boston never expected to get into the finals last year. They, you know, finished in fourth place in the NBA Eastern Conference last year, and really were playing with the house money, and were able to play loosey-goosey, and probably that's why they were able to take the Los Angeles Lakers to seven games last year. And I see a lot of the same type of attitude right now with the Memphis Grizzlies. No way in the world were they expected to get by the San Antonio Spurs. Everybody thought it was going to be a close series, and everybody thought that San Antonio would not probably make it out of the second or third round, but nobody really expected Memphis to be able to take it to them and as severely as they did. So they're playing with house money right now. I don't think they have any fear, but I think, as I said, the biggest detriment to that team last night was they lost home court advantage, or they gave it back to Oklahoma City when they lost the game on their own home floor last night.
Now, moving forward, obviously this series is going to wrap up. You have the Dallas Mavericks sitting there resting. Who do you think the Dallas Mavericks would prefer to play, the Grizzlies or the Oklahoma City Thunder?
Well, we talked about this earlier today, and I think that the Thunder is a better matchup for Dallas than the Grizzlies are. Gasol scares me at the center position. And I don't know that Tyson Chandler really has what it takes to be able to shut that guy down. You got Randolph going up against Nowitzki. Nowitzki, of course, is one of the better players in the NBA today, but Randolph certainly is no slouch. And I like Conley a lot better than I like Jason Kidd at this point of his career, though Jason can pull one out of his hat, you know, every once in a while. He can't do it on a consistent basis that he was able to do it even 3-4 years ago. So I would think if I'm Dallas, I'm rooting for OKC because I think that Dallas has a much better chance of beating OKC than they do Memphis. Though I think Dallas could probably get by either series. They're going to have a lot tougher time against Memphis than they would against OKC, in my opinion. Your thoughts?
Yeah. Well, I actually agree with you. I think Oklahoma City is a better matchup, and I think it would really be a fun series to see Dirk Nowitzki and Kevin Durant on the floor together in a very high pace, fast paced series. I think that would be great to see. But gosh, I'm starting to wonder if we can really count Memphis out, and they might find a way to sneak one out tomorrow night in Oklahoma City and go back to the FedEx Forum and close this thing out. That wouldn't shock me one bit the way they've played and the way Zach Randolph has played overall. And, you know, with the numbers and, you know, with Conley coming into his own, and we talked about how he has really stepped his game up from the regular season, you know, to where he's at right now, averaging almost 20 points a game. And Randolph and Gasol have been amazing. And the on-ball defensive, you know, Tony Allen and Shane Battier, I think, is very intriguing as well. I think they kind of get lost in the shuffle a little bit, but their on-the-ball defense has been phenomenal for Memphis throughout the playoffs. Now, speaking of the Mavericks, and we talked – yeah, he didn't have a great game last night, but defensively with him and Shane Battier, I think they create some real matchup problems, you know, make guys really work hard on the offensive end that don't necessarily want to, you know, work that hard on that end of the floor.
Tony Allen was a very key and very underrated player for the Boston Celtics for all the years he was with that team, and he's proven to be a leader and kind of come into the mold of a Randolph. You know, been a veteran leader since he's come with that team. Shane Battier is without a doubt one of the classiest young men in all of professional sports. I have had the pleasure of, and the displeasure sometimes, of dealing with probably just about every major professional athlete in the NFL, the NBA, and Major League Baseball from 1995 to 2006. Except for Barry Bonds, I've pretty much met them all. And I'll tell you something, Shane Battier is just an absolute class guy on and off the court, never gets riled, just an absolute gentleman in post-game press conferences, and truly treats you like you're something special, whether you've been doing it for 11, you know, 20 years or whatever, or it's your first week on the beat. Shane Battier is that type of guy. It was a great trade for Memphis, picking him up from Houston late in the season, and he's proved to be a go-to player in these playoffs so far. I originally thought Oklahoma City was going to run away with this series as well, Ryan. I thought it was going to be a five-game series, just like I thought the Bulls and Hawks was going to be a five-game series. Right now, it's too close to call. My head's going with Oklahoma City, but my heart is not ready to call this one by any stretch of the imagination. They are two tough teams, and anything can happen. We've seen a lot of strange things happen in this series so far, so I'm not ready to call this series by any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah, I'm hoping that it goes seven games because I would love to watch these guys play some more basketball. There's no doubt about it. Moving on with the Western Conference, Jeff, you know, we have the Dallas Mavericks and the Los Angeles Lakers. Everybody's talking about the Lakers, but I want to start off with what the Dallas Mavericks did this weekend to the two-time defending champs, the Los Angeles Lakers, sweeping them. And really, it was a demolition of the Lakers in Dallas this past weekend. I mean, Dallas lit them up from three. 20 of 32 from three-point range at 65%. Jason the Jet Terry, 9 for 10. Peja Stojakovic, who many thought, he doesn't have anything left of the tank. He's still a great spot-up shooter, 6 for 6 from three. The Mavs, right along, I brought this up on the show, they've had 11 years in a row of postseason play. One of the only teams, you know, as far as, you know, you look at Boston, the Spurs, Lakers, teams that have some mileage on them as far as NBA basketball is concerned, really the only veteran team that's played very well and really been the most consistent all season. What do you think about the way they really demolished the Lakers? And if Caron Butler comes back or is able to come back for this next series, should they play him?
According to the president of the Mavericks, he will not be back this year. He said basically it was impossible for him to be back this year. So let's rule him out of the picture.
Okay.
I think probably the most telling statistic of Game 4 was the fact that Dirk Nowitzki was the fourth leading scorer on the Dallas Mavericks with 17 points. He didn't even need to be a factor for them to crush the Lakers as massively as they did. Bench just came through big, big time. As you mentioned, Stojakovic and Jason Terry just were absolutely incredible. It was their bench that basically won that game for them. I think the Lakers basically laid down and died in that game four. They really did not show a lot of enthusiasm. They really did not show a lot of drive that we've seen throughout this season and throughout previous seasons from a Los Angeles Lakers team. And then they got caught up in the moment as the game progressed, as both Andrew Bynum and Lamar Odom, of course, were ejected from the game for technical fouls. And Bynum, of course, got fined today, five games at the beginning of next season, and he's going to end up paying about $702,000 before it's all said and done to the NBA for his blatant disrespect of Jose Wambaria on Sunday. Just an absolutely atrocious act. Threw him across the floor like he was a rag doll, a guy that he has over a foot on as far as height and probably about 100 pounds as far as weight. And to see soft serve Bynum, a guy who does have talent but literally goes down when he gets a hangnail, beating up on a little guy like that just made the crime even more heinous and more disgusting to watch.
Yeah, I completely agree. It's probably one of the most classless things you'll ever see, especially from someone in a Lakers uniform, and a cheap shot to say the least. And I think that, you know, players don't like that. Guys in the Lakers locker room didn't like that. And I think people are going to remember that next season. You know, I think if there is a season next year, and that's a whole different ball of wax we won't get into tonight, but, I mean, I think players are going to remember that. They're going to like, you know what, that was a cheap shot. Players don't like that. Guys in his locker room don't like that. And that leads me to my next question. You know, the Lakers, obviously, with the roster they have great pieces. They have a lot of talent, of course. You know, the Phil Jackson situation, we can get into that here in a bit. But what do the Lakers do? What moves do they make? Is Andrew Bynum one of those pieces to move to get maybe a Chris Paul or a Dwight Howard in the offseason?
Well, I don't think you're going to get Dwight Howard by any stretch of the imagination. Orlando would be absolutely insane to give him up. He is the heart and soul of that franchise and by far, the best pivot man in the NBA today. When it comes to centers in the NBA, there is Dwight Howard, and then there is everybody else, and nobody else is even close. Brook Lopez may have the potential to eventually become a Dwight Howard, but to me, he's the only guy right now on the radar that even has the potential to do it. So I would say them getting Dwight Howard is basically almost an impossibility. Chris Paul or a point guard of that ilk would be a huge, huge, huge asset for the Los Angeles Lakers, as right now they are relying on Methuselah himself, Derek Fisher, whose best days are far behind them, and Steve Blake, who really did a decent job in Portland, but I think that was more due to his relationship with Brandon Roy than anything else. The guy is certainly not an athlete by any stretch of the imagination. He's not a speedy kid, he's got an inconsistent outside shot. And not really a guy that I would have a lot of confidence in having him run my offense down the stretch. So a point guard is a definite need for this team. Small forward is a definite need for that team as well, as Ron Artest, though he had a great year last season, really played below expectations this season. Of course, had it out in a celebrated feud with Phil Jackson back in January as the two got into a screaming match during practice. And there were rumors that Artest was on his way out the door before the February trade deadline took place. He did survive the season, but did not have a good postseason. Of course, was suspended for Game 3 of the series because he had had a little bit of disrespect issues with Barea earlier in the series. And so I would not be surprised to see Ron Artest on the way out the door and with yet another franchise next year. But I think it all comes down to who's going to be their head coach next year. Does Jackson come back? As we discussed earlier today on the phone, this is a guy who's basically the Michael Jordan of coaching, or the Magic Johnson of coaching, if you want to go back to an earlier guy. Michael, of course, came back, you know, three times to play his NBA career. And Jackson has been the boy who cried wolf many, many times when it comes to hanging up his clipboard and walking away from the bench. There were large speculation last year that he would not come back for this year. He's talked about that already. I just can't see him going out the way he did. There was a big article in the LA Times yesterday about the fact that his four adult children came to watch that final game in Dallas on Sunday, and they stood outside the locker room crying. And his son was quoted as saying, "We are going to look back at Dad's career with absolute adulation, but we do not want to remember the way it ended." And I don't know that he wants to remember the way it ended, and maybe because of that, he won't allow it to end on that note. And he could pull an 11th-hour surprise and be back on that bench next year. There's no doubt in my mind that that's a possibility. Whether he has enough left in the tank or whether he is truly burnt out from the association and the NBA at this point, I think that's going to be the determining factor. And whether he does come back next year or not. If not, it's probably going to be Brian Shaw or somebody of that ilk. Probably not a guy with a lot of experience. And if that's the case, then you do wipe the slate clean and you start the franchise all over again. Kobe's your untouchable. I would think Gasol stays there as well, but you never can tell. Again, the soft cards started coming out again this series after they got crushed by Dallas. Though he's proven himself as to be a warrior against the Magic 2 years ago and against the Celtics last year, he's back in that same boat of having that soft reputation again. And really undeserved as far as I'm concerned. You know, Jackson is probably his biggest critic in the NBA. He's constantly riding Gasol for getting hurt, whereas Bynum can get hurt 25, 30 times a year, and Jackson really doesn't make a remark about that. Now, that could be expectations. You know, maybe he realizes that Bynum's pain threshold is so low that he's not even going to bother to comment on that, and he feels he can motivate Gasol by being a little bit of a dick to the guy. I'm not really sure, but for whatever the reason, he's always on Gasol's behind whenever he gets hurt, yet Bynum is able to go on the injured list whenever he wants, and nary a comment is made.
Yeah, I remember watching a couple games, and Jackson would be like, well, he's making an effort, I guess, or there's some backhanded remark that he'll make on the sidelines with Craig Sager or in the post game or something. It's an interesting note you bring up. I like Pau Gasol. I think he's a very, very skilled player and does get a lot of criticism. I think this series, it was rightfully so. I'd be surprised if they move him. I think, after Bynum's, classless move there to close the game out. I would think that they may try to move him and maybe Lamar Odom, and they have some other pieces off the bench. I think Ron Artest won't be there. I really think that. I think they need to go for a solid number one and have Kobe as a second option, I think, at this point in his career. That's just my opinion. I just don't see you know, especially the way his NBA is structured right now, you have the young teams in the West. So we talked about Memphis and Oklahoma City. And then, you know, obviously the power has really switched to the Eastern Conference with Miami. I think New York next year will be very good. I just wonder if – Yeah, the Thunder as well. And if the Philadelphia 76ers, I think, another team that are up and coming, and as well as the Indiana Pacers. So teams that have a lot of promise and a lot of young pieces. I just don't know what Kobe at this stage, you know, he's been in the league, what, 15, 16 seasons now? All the postseason games, that equals almost to really another extra season. I just don't know if he has enough in him to be the main number one option. And I don't know if his ego would let him be the number two option if they brought in a Chris Paul or someone like that.
Bingo. Bingo, you just said the magic words, his ego. And that's the fly in the Vaseline that the Lakers are going to have to deal with if they do bring in another guy to be the number one scoring option on that team. Can Kobe, at 33 years old, say to himself, okay, you know what, my best days are behind me. Even though last year I had eclipsed Magic and people were starting to compare with me with Michael. I wasn't able to get it done this year. The dings and the bings and the bangs and all the bruises got the best of me, and I was not able to show the explosiveness in this last series that I showed in previous playoff series, and it's time for me to take a step back. I don't know that Kobe Bryant has that kind of team mentality to allow that to happen. I think he has improved as far as being a teammate, and I think the Olympics were a major factor in that a couple of years ago because he saw under Mike Krzyzewski and playing with the players that he did, including Jason Kidd, that it truly took a team to win an NBA championship or win an Olympic title in that particular case. And I think that's allowed him to become more trusting and become more receptive to being a team-type player with the Lakers. Whether he's able to take it to that next level at this stage of his career is something that I really truly doubt at this point. So I don't know that you're going to be able to do that successfully and still have Kobe coexist happily with another number one on that team. I believe that the Lakers are a better team when they do not have Andrew Bynum in the starting lineup than they are when they do have him. I think that all Lamar Odom and whoever they have at small forward are a much better starting unit than they are with Odom coming off the bench and Bynum in the middle. And I think the record shows as much as well. Though Bynum did have some great games, especially in the first round of the series with a bunch of double-doubles. When it came down to it, he just couldn't get it done during this series. And again, I just think they're a tougher team and a better team when Bynum is not in the lineup than when Bynum is.
Yep. Yeah, I have to agree with you. It remains to be seen, and, you know, I guess we'll find out. As far as the NBA obviously has a lot of questions and things to answer in this offseason. And you know, it remains to be seen what in the heck is going to happen, if there's going to be an NBA season at all. But very good stuff, Jeff. Again, great. Thank you for having us on the show. Is there anything you want to add? Do you want to make a prediction for the finals?
No, not at this point, brother, to be not perfectly yet. Honest with you. I have done so abysmally in all my picks for this round that I'm not about to go out on a limb any further than I already have, except to say that it's going to be a great NBA postseason all the way through the finals, no matter who makes it. You would have to think right now the prohibitive favorites are going to be Miami and Dallas. Unfortunately, I think if it came down to that, I think we would see Miami probably repeat what they did in 2006 and win the NBA championship all over again. As much as I would hate to see it, as much as I would hate to see LeBron James get his first title in his first year away from the Cleveland Cavaliers, that, when all is said and done, may be exactly the way it plays out. As far as plugging anything, the only thing I really want to plug is my website, and for all your listeners and viewers, You can go to my website, which is called NBA Overtime, and the URL on that is NBAOvertime.wordpress.com. And as we are known, we are your number one source for NBA information. So come on down, check us out. We are covering the playoffs with great intensity right now. There's some great opinion articles as well as the bread and butter, meat and potatoes articles on the playoff games themselves. And I promise, you may not agree with everything I say, but you will certainly not be bored. And you won't go away without having an opinion yourself from NBA Overtime. That's a promise for sure.
Wonderful. Hey, Jeff, thanks for being on the show. It's an honor to have you. Hey, would you be interested in coming back on during the finals?
My pleasure, my brother. You give me a call. I am there whenever you need me. You're a Wonderful. Great friend, and I've known you for a lot of years now, and it's been a pleasure being part of your life and seeing you grow as much as you have over the last few years. You handle yourself fantastically. You run the show great. I had a great time, a lot of great, intriguing questions, and hopefully I did a good job for you.
Jeff, you nailed it out of the park as far as I'm concerned. Thanks a lot, and we look forward to having you on again.
My pleasure, brother. I look forward to your call. Thank you, Mike.
Hey, take care, man. Have a good one.
You too, bud.
Hey, everyone, thanks for tuning in. Hey, this is Ryan from Unsigned, and that was the great Jeff Sack, the Sack Man, giving his NBA analysis in detail. You're only going to get that here on Unsigned. Great stuff from Jeff Sack, breaking down every single series, Eastern Conference, Western Conference, players, coaches, numbers, stats, you name it. We covered it all here tonight on Unsigned. That's what you're going to get when you tune in. And you know what? We're going to shift gears a little bit. We're running a little long time than we typically do, and that's fine. That's you know, when you get someone of the caliber of Jeff Sack on the show, you just got to go with it, and he's delivered 100%. And we're going to jump right into a segment we call Off the Path. We do this every week where we kind of, you know, step back from sports and we talk, you know, movies and things of this nature. It's going to be a short version this week. I want to talk summer movies much as I did last week. It's really in full swing. Fast Five really let it off. Starring in that movie is Dwayne The Rock Johnson. They opened up last weekend with $86 million. Now, this past weekend, as I mentioned, the movie Thor hit theaters in 3D. Hits the theaters this past Friday. I had a chance to go see this film Friday night at 11:30 p.m. For a late night showing with my wife. Hey, you get free tickets, you got to take advantage, right? Now, when seeing this film, again, it very much anticipated. The previews, which I always enjoy on a big feature film like this, were great. They really set you up for the summer films. The trailer for Captain America really looks very good. Looking forward to it. The movie X-Men First Class, which features a very young Professor Xavier and a very young Magneto, and how that came to fruition, looks like a very well done film. Also, the full trailer for the movie Super 8, which has been out, the movie Super 8 has been much talked about for well over a year now. You finally get to see the full trailer of Super 8, and that trailer is phenomenal. It kind of leaves you wondering, what is on that train? What is happening? What's going on in this movie? I need to know. That's kind of the vibe that I got from that trailer. Very exciting. And then you look at the feature film, Thor, the God of Thunder. I'm not going to give a real in detail, into the movie because I don't want to give too much away. But if you're into the comic books, it's a no-brainer. You got to go see this movie. Now, if you're not into, you know, the comic books, or you don't understand or don't know a lot about the backstory, I think the film does a good job setting up Odin, the father of Thor, played by Anthony Hopkins, by the way. Odin, it really, you know, it details how he came into his place, and the 3D is very well done. I really liked it a lot. It's well worth the extra admission. The 3D views of Asgard brought to you in a magical view into a different world that I thought was great. The humor aspect from the character Thor and also the struggle of Thor was very well done. Thor is played by Chris Hemsworth, who he does a very phenomenal job. And the brother of Thor, Loki, I thought was very well planned and created well to kind of show the sinister side of Thor's brother and really a good backstory to the movie leading up to the Avenger movies, which, you know, is going to include Iron Man, the Hulk, Thor, Captain America. So if you're a huge fan of those comic book stories, and they're just, if you like really good stories in general, it's a good film to see. Thor, the God of Thunder. It's a nice Hollywood mix as well. There's a nice little love story underlined with it. It's a very visually stunning film with the 3D. I give it a solid 3 out of 4 microphones. I think it's a must-see. Even if you're not into the comic books, if you just want to go see a good action-packed, fun movie, it's visually stunning. It's well acted out. You have Anthony Hopkins is in the movie. Go see it. It's well worth it. Also, it's Thor, the God of Thunder. Now, we're going to break down the top 10 at the box office like we do every week. We'll start with number 10, work your way up. Number 10, Hoodwink 2, Hood vs. Evil, 2.2 million. The movie Prom, 2.3 million. Soul Surfer, Hanging In, based on a true story, 2.3 million. Tyler Perry's Madam's Big Happy Family, still hanging in at 4.1 million. That's still a surprise to me. Water for Elephants, which is another movie I'd like to see, at 6 million at number 6. Rio the Movie, animated film, 8.5 million. Southern Borrowed, 13.9 million. Jump the Broom, 15.2 million. Fast Five still had a great big weekend, 32.4 million. And Thor, not to be outdone, I mean, 65.7 million. Not as big as Fast Five, but I think in the long run, Thor is going to withhold and bring in a lot of money. And that concludes this session of Off the Path, and we do it every week here on Unsigned. Now, as I mentioned last week, I'm a big fan of boxing, and there was a really good fight this past Saturday. Manny Pacquiao versus Sugar Shane Mosley. Manny Pacquiao really dominated this fight from start to finish. Really wasn't much of a contest. Sugar Shane Mosley looked like his face was made out of hamburger meat by the time it was over with. Credit to him for not throwing in the towel. Maybe he should have. You know, Sugar Shane Mosley, 39 years old. He's a veteran boxer. He stuck it out. Now, one thing I will say, Manny Pacquiao had a real hard time late in this fight really getting inside of Mosley. And that's because I think Mosley was really wanted no – after about 6-7 rounds, Mosley was just like, let's just get 12 rounds over with. At this point, you know, he was basically covering up and protecting himself because Pacquiao was just all over him. As you can see the image there of – Pacquiao getting, you know, the right hook to the face, and that was a reoccurring event during the fight. Now, this leaves me to ask, what's left for Manny Pacquiao? Now, some will think he's going to fight Juan Manuel Marquez for the third time after their 2004 fight ended in a draw. Manny Pacquiao defeated Marquez in a split decision for the WBO super featherweight title on March 15, 2008. Now, I would like to see Marquez Pacquiao 3. I think it would be very good for boxing. But what would be great for boxing would be Floyd Mayweather versus Manny Pacquiao. Everybody's, you know, they've been talking about this fight for about a year and a half now. I don't know if it's ever going to happen. I hope that it does. Now, obviously, we all know Floyd Mayweather has some legal issues that are going to get in the way. I think it's great for boxing. It's great for fans. And let's face it, there's a lot of money to be made for Pacquiao and Mayweather to get into the ring. Now, Mayweather's legal issues, again, are going to be an issue. But I also think after, you know, seeing Pacquiao fight Sugar Shane Mosley, I wonder if Mayweather really wants any of Manny Pacquiao whatsoever. Because it's going to be the first time Mayweather's ever really going to be hit. And he's going to be hit a lot in his career. If he steps in the ring versus Manny Pacquiao, remains to be seen. I guess we'll wait and see. Come on, boxing promoters, Golden Boy Productions. Somebody get this thing. Let's make it happen. Pacquiao versus Mayweather. I'd love to see it. I'd watch it. Also on the undercard, Kelly Pavlik from Youngstown, Ohio, made his comeback last night with a majority decision over Alfonso Lopez. So congratulations to Kelly the Ghost Pavlik for making his return and getting the W. Other notable boxing fights coming up. We talked about the Klitschko fight coming up in June. Another one coming up on HBO is Jean Pascal versus Bernard Hopkins 2. That's going to be a good fight. These guys do not like one another at all. They're going after the WBC IBO light heavyweight title. That should be a good fight. Bernard Hopkins, one of a kind. I don't think there'll be many fighters at his weight class to fight as long as he has at the age of 44. Unbelievable. That's going to be a good fight. So if you have HBO, check that out. May the 21st. Now here's something I wanted to bring up, and we may elaborate this more on this next week. This is a story that I had come across on Fox News. And 8-year-old soccer players from southern Sweden were suspended after several parents chased a teenage referee around the field during a soccer game. The parents were angry that were so angry about a bad decision by a 16-year-old referee. The youth referee trainer, Bujar Fida, was also attacked and threatened when he tried to intervene. This is unbelievable behavior. I mean, I understand, you know, parents get into it. I remember, you know, playing baseball as a youth and basketball as a youth, you know, where parents would get a little emotional and get a little amped up. And that's fine to a certain extent. But when you have officials, you know, these are 16-year-old kids. You have to give them some encouragement, even if it's a bad call. Keep your emotions and check it as a 16-year-old kid, you know, doing the best he can. And I like the fact, and I like the scenario of, you know, 16, 17-year-olds coaching and refereeing and enforcing rules in a youth soccer game. I think that's great. As far as that's concerned, I think it's very good for the sport. It's good for the 16-year-old player, also for when he goes to play his soccer game and is ref by an adult. He'll understand the decisions and calls that are made while he's on the field as well, and then can pass that on to the younger players. But for the parents to chase and threaten these kids, and really the losers in this, you talk about the parents, you know, getting angry and acting out, but the real losers in this are the 18-year-old kids. The kids playing soccer are the real losers here. They're not going to get the benefit of that extracurricular activity because of an emotionally charged emotional event from adults that should know better. Unbelievable when you hear stories like this. I know it's in Sweden, but it happens everywhere. And this story just happened to get a little bit of publicity and news through Fox Sports. I wanted to bring it up tonight. You know, feel free, you know, send me a message on Twitter, Ryan_unsigned, if you want to weigh in on it. You know, it'd be interesting to see your thoughts. I think it's a despicable act, and I feel sorry for the 7, 8, 9-year-old kids that are going to lose your soccer season. That's who I feel sorry for. And the 16-year-old kid who was threatened by the parents of these kids. Ridiculous. Well, I mean, it's not like the World Cup, right? I mean, we're talking 7, 8-year-old soccer here. Amazing how some people get sometimes, you know? Hey, it's time for the Major League Baseball Recap. Refreshing. Major League Baseball is in full swing. We'll start with the AL Central. Watch out, Yankees. They've been in first place all year, and now all of a sudden they find themselves in a first-place tie with the Tampa Bay Rays, who, I mean, since, you know, they had a very poor start, they had the Manny Ramirez situation down there. They seem to kind of find themselves winning 7 of their last 10 and have themselves 11-4 road record. They can find a way to win some games at home. They're going to be right there and really push the Yankees for first place in the AL East. Be interesting to see. A lot of baseball to go, but Tampa Bay Rays slowly chip away, now in a tie. The AL Central, the Indians still hold a 4.5-game lead over the Central Division, and this young team has really had an all-around game. Solid pitching from the bullpen, great hitting, timely hitting to boot. The young bullpen has been very solid, and we close in the middle of the May. The Indians now have people thinking, this is not a fluke. This is no joke. The Indians have a 4.5-game lead over the Kansas City Royals, but the Tigers, I think, are starting to catch and get in the stride. The Tigers, the Detroit Tigers, are closing the gap. They're only 5 games. They were around 8 games last week. And Justin Verlander pitched a no-hitter through the weekend. The Tigers, are going to try to close the gap in the Indians. Be interesting to see how that folds out, especially with Kansas City right in between them. AL Central, the Indians, shocking everybody. Hey, go Tribe. AL West, the Los Angeles Angels, the Anaheim Angels, hold a 1-game lead over the Oakland A's. Now, the Angels last week were in Boston to play the Red Sox, and they were a part of a 7-hour and 35-minute game the other night that featured a 2.5-hour rain delay. Nothing better than baseball in Boston at 1 a.m. The Angels do prevail. Now, we're heading to the National League. A pitching duel that took place with the Atlanta Braves and the Philadelphia Phillies, who still hold the first place spot, only a 3-game lead now. And it was really a classic pitching duel between former Indian Cliff Lee, who threw 16 strikeouts. He punched the ticket for 16 batters in a losing effort. How many times do you hear this guy struck out 16 people in a losing effort only because rival Atlanta Braves pitcher Derek Lowe threw a no-hitter? Unbelievable. If you're a fan of pitching, that was the game to watch right there. The Phillies still holding a 3-game lead. The NL Central, the Arizona Cardinals hold a 1-game lead over the Cincinnati Reds, who was my pick to win the division in the preseason. This race is going to go down to the wire, as I thought it would. And a shock to many, the Pittsburgh Pirates are still over 500 in May for the first time since 2004. They haven't finished with a winning record in almost 11 seasons. It's good to see the Pirates are competing above 500. They're only really a game out, or excuse me, 2 games out of first place of the Cardinals and right on the heels of the Cincinnati Reds. Now, the NL West, last week we thought, maybe the Rockies, Colorado Rockies, were going to run away with it. All of a sudden, they lose 7 out of 10. They only have a game and a half lead. And the defending champ, San Francisco Giants, are right on their heels. Again, it's only mid-May, not even mid-May at this point. A lot of baseball to go, about 130 games or so. So we'll see how it goes. But this has been your Major League Baseball recap. Refreshing. Hey, my name is Ryan. This is Unsigned. I hope you enjoyed the night. Again, I want to thank Jeff Sack for coming in and doing a wonderful job and really giving us an in-depth analysis and a really in-depth look at the NBA playoffs and the National Basketball Association. Always great to have someone of that caliber on the show. Mike, again, wonderful job producing and engineering for Omnis TV. And I want to give a shout-out to Cooker Carolyn on Twitter. I want to give a shout-out to her. Hey, go ahead and check recipes. She just cooked some of her fried chicken tonight. It was wonderful. It was very good stuff. A lot of great recipes, whether it's dessert, a nice snack or a meal, a healthy meal. You want to, find a nice sauce for your wings that you're cooking on the grill this summer. Pick up Carolyn's cookbook at Cooker Carolyn on Twitter. Good stuff. Cooker Carolyn, C-O-O-K-E-R, Carolyn on Twitter. Hey, my name is Ryan. This has been a supersized episode of Unsigned. It seems harder to enjoy the finer things in life. Until then, do so, everybody. Have a good one. Take care. See you next week.